For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host Red Sail, and coming up this week, Femi Kayode transports us to Nigeria for his tense thriller Light Seekers. Children's author Anjali Q. Ralph introduces us to the boy at the back of the class. And blind author Bill Skitworth discusses his memoir, Now I See. That's all coming up on today's Read On. Femi Kayode has just published his debut novel, Light Seekers, a slice of Nigerian noir that follows a forensic psychologist as he investigates the lynching of three students in a remote town in Nigeria. He joined Read On producer Hannah Taus from his home in Namibia to discuss being an outsider in one's own country, the mindset of mob violence, and the impact of Nigerian fiction.
Femi Kayode, welcome to Read On.
Thank you for having me.
So can you give us a bit of an introduction to Light Seekers?
Light Seekers is basically inspired by a series of very real life situations that some sort of happens a bit too frequently in Nigeria. But in this particular case, it's inspired by the lynching and burning alive of four undergraduate students in the southern part of Nigeria. And what I did with the novel was to create a fictional character who is an investigative psychologist and has been, you know, given the task of finding out why the students, in this case, in the case of the book, three students are burnt alive by these villagers in this university town. And his journey just sort of takes him through interviewing people, finding out what led to the lynching, how did it happen, and all that. And I think in the process, we get to meet very, very interesting characters. We get to find out, you know, what makes people tick? Why are people so afraid? And so there are a lot of sociological issues that are brought up in the story that's just supposed to create a certain level of complexity and to give maybe the reader a bird's eye view, a closer insight into why things are the way they are in Nigeria.
As you say, your protagonist, Philip Taiwo, is a psychologist rather than a detective. Now,
yes.
You also have a background in clinical psychology. So is that why you decided to write a why done it rather than a traditional who done it?
I think so, yeah, definitely. Although I did train as a clinical psychologist, I never really practiced because I realized very early on, as soon as I left school and I did start my PhD, I realized that this was not for me. Every time when I was in therapy or I was in class, I found that I was constantly daydreaming about the other possibilities of what the story really is, kind of thing. So I realized that I was not going to be any great help to my patients if I did take the clinical psychology route. I like the fantasy and I like to create the stories behind the story. But coming back to Light Seekers, I think the real issue was that I was very interested in, I had a personal vested interest in why this kind of crime happens in Nigeria. I was very, very interested in why people would do this to another human being. And I didn't have any answers. And I felt like if I was able to create a character that would ask the same kind of questions that I would ask, it would really, really help me to almost navigate my conflict about my homeland and about my people, in a sense. And so I think it was a no-brainer for me to use a psychologist. So I think even if I did not study psychology, I would have still used somebody of that inclination, so to speak, as my protagonist.
Part of Philip's background is that he spent years living in America and he obviously feels quite out of place back in Nigeria. And in a way, his ability to get to the truth seems to be hampered by having quite a Western psyche. Now, you've moved around quite a lot. Nigeria, UK, the US, you're in Namibia now.
Yeah.
Do you suffer from that same sort of disconnection, as it were, to how life is in Nigeria?
Yes, I do. Absolutely. And I think that is one of the reasons why I totally identify with Philip Taiwo. Because when you've been away for so long and you've lived in many different societies and communities, you do come home with a different set of eyes. And sometimes we can be a bit patronizing. We can sometimes be almost like we have some kind of a superiority complex because we've seen things that others haven't seen, and we become a bit more judgmental in a way. And so what I wanted to do was also to walk through some of my conflicted feelings about Nigeria. And the more I did that, the more I was able to realize that, you know, at the end of the day, we are all just humans, and circumstances and the society and the community and a lot of factors contribute to where we are today. It can be political, it can be sociological, it can be psychological, but there are just so many things that contribute to why we are the way we are, whether we're in the UK, whether it's because of Brexit, whether it's because of Meghan Markle and Harry in the US, whether it's because of Twitter wars and filibusters. You know, there are just so many reasons that contribute to why people become the way they are. But at the end of it, at the essence of it, is that we all react similarly when confronted with similar factors, similar influences, so to speak. And for me, that was a very liberating experience, just journeying through writing the book and getting to the point where you can say, we are all humans, you know. So, yeah, I think for me, it was very, very important for me to have a character like Philip that would ask those questions. And he was sort of like my eyes, in a sense, and my heart, in a sense.
Talking about Nigeria, it's very much a character all of its own in the novel. Some of the subjects that you bring up include corruption, the mob violence, of course, and particularly the confraternities and universities. Mm. And this is in really stark contrast to the very strong sense of morality that Philip has, the desperation of the victim's father to find the truth, and the unexpected assistance of some of the characters. Would you say that that kind of reflects Nigerian society as a whole, both the good and the brutally bad?
Oh, that's such an interesting question. And the only way I can answer it is it's something that came up once. And somebody went to Nigeria and landed at the airport, a European, and he was apparently robbed at the airport. And he had no passport, he had no bags, and he was just like literally robbed. And as he stood outside the airport, in less than 5 minutes of stating his case to a couple of onlookers, somebody was like, oh, get in the car, get in the car. And somebody took him to their house and, you know, they took care of him. And they're like, no, don't worry, we're going to take care of you. They took him to the embassy and they took care of him without asking for anything. And he always tells that story about how complex the community or the society is. That on the one hand, he was robbed. And in the same hand, he experienced the highest level of kindness, human kindness that you could ever ask for. And so that complexity is really what Light Seekers is about. They are good people and they are bad people, and they are corrupt people and they are honest people. They are people with integrity and they are people without integrity. And again, it goes back to exactly what it is. It's just humanity in its all its complexity. So for me, that question that you just asked me is just so insightful, because that is exactly what the book is about. It's supposed to actually present the country or the society in a much more three-dimensional way than you would see in the media or that you read in books. I didn't want to tell a single story. I really wanted to tell a multifaceted story about a very complex community. I can't even say a complex country, but more of a complex people.
Now, Philip has a sidekick, Chika, who is far more than just the driver that he's introduced us originally. He's just meant to be there to be helping him out. And Chika and Philip have quite a complex relationship. It's full of secrets, and yet it's surprisingly intimate as well in some ways. How much did you enjoy writing that particular relationship?
It was the most fun. It was really the most fun. I think I've always been interested in something that I actually have not really experienced in most of my travels, and that is a genuine friendship between men. Mm-hmm. I've been in situations where you're friends with people at different levels. You know, there's your drinking friend, and then there's your family friend, and there's your work friend, you know. So there's all this categorization of the type of friends. Or maybe because I've always been a foreigner So I've always fallen into a category of friendship in the different places that I've lived. But in Nigeria, that was what I missed the most, the completeness of friendship. You don't go drinking with your friend and you don't discuss politics and you don't discuss your marital woes and you don't discuss your family and you don't you discuss everything. It's a 360 relationship. And I really wanted to explore that because I missed it a lot in all my travels. I missed a lot of my friends and that kind of relationship. And so I think Philip and Chika's relationship was very, very dear to me. But to be honest, in terms of all of Lightseekers, the parts that I enjoyed writing the most were the relationships between husband and wife, between friends, between, you can even say boss and employee, the relationships between the chief and the villagers, So I think that's the psychologist in me. I really love writing about relationships and the dynamics of relationships and the levels that we tend to approach these relationships. And somebody once told me that one of the things that they love most about Lightseekers is the relationship between fathers and sons. And I think that's also something that really comes across as a theme. It really is about relationships. Yeah.
The story is inspired by the real life necklace killings back in 2012 of the Alufor, is it? Mm-hmm. Which was also in Port Harcourt, where most of the book is set. How much of the book is a fictionalized account of that sort of mob violence, and how much of it is based on real facts?
To be honest, I really wanted to be as close to the facts as possible while I was writing the book, and I would get stuck. And mm-hmm. I think there was a part of me that had this wall that really refused to believe, and I could not write convincingly about the facts because I couldn't understand it. And I really only felt completely liberated when I went purely into the realm of fiction. So I would read the facts and I'll say, what if it happened differently? What if that's not what actually happened, kind of thing. So I would say the only thing that is a bit real, the only fact there is that it happened in Port Harcourt, but every other thing, including the university, the names, the village, everything was changed completely. I only found true freedom when I went in the purely fictionalized space. So I can't say that there's any fact beyond the fact that Alufor happened. It's interesting because I did do a lot of research and I was inspired by Capote's In Cold Blood, mm-hmm. which was based on another crime in the United States then. And I kept on thinking to myself, I don't know whether I wanted to profit from such misery. And the more I thought about it, the more I became determined to deviate from the facts as much as possible. I think the week I finished the book was the day the trial of the Alufor was over and they sentenced, I think, four of the accused to death. But I could see the pain on the parents' face. It was such an unfinished business. And I didn't think I wanted to be part of that.
So you're also a screenwriter. How much of an effect did that have on the way that you wrote the novel? Did you write it in a, I can see this as a screenplay? Or did you write it purely as a novel?
It was written as a novel, but I wrote it with the eyes of the camera. So of all the influences that I had as a writer, I think my screenwriting experience was the strongest in writing the novel. Not the psychology background, not the fact that I'm Nigerian, but the fact that I'm a screenwriter. And I really wanted to write a story where I wanted to put the reader in the scene. I wanted them to literally be on Philip's shoulder, seeing what he sees. So I really felt very strongly about a visual story that people could see, and then Philip's mind or his narrator voice would explain what they're seeing. So it was very important for me to do that because I really love visual novels. It was deliberately written that way to be as visual as possible, to give the reader, I think what I would call an immersive experience. I don't know whether I succeeded that well, but that was the intention. And it could be almost like even if they're reading it in Russia or they're reading it in the US or they're reading it in Congo, you would feel as if you're actually physically there. That was the intention. And the only way I could do that was to write it, one, in the present tense, two, with a very visual, the camera hanging or the reader's eye on Philip's shoulder kind of thing. And I think to be as present as possible.
I think it worked very successfully. I certainly felt the heat and the dust, and I could picture the roads.
And the food, Hannah. Philip is a foodie.
Now, Nigerian literature has become very popular over the last few years in the West. We've had My Sister the Serial Killer, we've had Purple Hibiscus, we've had Ben Okri. What do you think accounts for this rise in interest at the moment?
What is really becoming very fascinating is the interest in Nigerian crime fiction.
The Nigerian noir.
Yeah, the Nigerian noir, or like my friend Leia Dinlis calls sunshine noir, you know.
you know, I think I prefer that term.
I love sunshine noir because, you know, in that you can feel the heat and you can feel the smiles of the people and the energy of the people and you can feel the music and so much. But to your question, I think the reason is because it's very multifaceted. There's an idea that one in every four Black person is a Nigerian. And there is literally no corner of the world that you go to that there's no Nigerian. So that actually says something. People are interested in this huge, it's all sort of the same way people are interested in Indian literature in a sense, you know, because they're everywhere. The Asian writers are everywhere and their understanding of the English language is phenomenal. Same thing with Nigeria. I always joke when you want to go and study in the UK and they say you should do this proficiency in English as a second language test. And I keep laughing. I'm like, no, English is practically my mother tongue. You know? You know, it's always very ridiculous because I'm like, that's what I grew up. I went to school learning English and all of that. But that's not the point of your question. The real issue is that I think there's a phenomenal rise across board of Nigerian creativity. So I think there's a fascination about this group of people and the fact that people are interested in trying to find out what makes them tick for good or for bad. And the fact that, you know what, let's call a spade, they do write well. They really are good writers. They're really good storytellers. And I think people are interested in that. And I really am very proud of the fact that I'm coming onto the stage around this time when so much work has been done in the past by the Ben Okris of this world, even by Onyeka's My Sister the Serial Killer. You know, just knowing that there's so many people that have done all the hard work in the past to open the gates for this interest to be stimulated, so to speak. It's a phenomenal group of people that's everywhere. They're talented, they're medical doctors, they're pastors in mega churches, they are criminals and they are kind people, they are charitable people. So everybody's curious about them and they have really talented people. I think the market will go where the audience is.
The audiobook opens up your literature to those who are print disabled. How much involvement did you have in the recording and did you get to choose the narrator yourself?
Yes, I did, actually. I think the audiobook, especially in the US, they sent me this wide array of voices and they told me to choose. I said, okay, give me a couple of days, then I will put the names into Google and then I will throw the voices on social media. Just, you know, just try to get a sense of who they were as people, not just as readers, so to speak, or performers. It's a very complex role to cast, I must say, Anna, because Philip has not lived in Nigeria for almost 20 years. So he has an American accent. He has to speak in a particular way for us to understand the fact that he's not American. So it was very difficult to cast. So that took us a long time. But I did get involved in the production. It was very, very exciting and it was very detailed. So I liked the outcome a lot. He didn't have to act. He really just was. And I actually know people that started reading the book and then they would switch to the audio. Then they would go back to the book. And they're like, it was very seamless.
Truth is, the hurried way I packed my bags and left home in the early hours of this morning had little to do with punctuality and everything to do with my unwillingness to ask my wife the question that was uppermost in my mind. Are you having an affair? It had taken a lot of willpower to tamp down that question this morning, as Falake stood in her light cotton housecoat, arms akimbo. Her long locks were pulled back from her face, so there was no masking her disapproval as she watched me pack. You're really doing this? Yes, I grunted, and made a show of counting some underpants. And it doesn't matter that I think it's a bad idea. I placed boxes in my suitcase and responded in what I hoped was a well-crafted, neutral voice. We've been through this, Falake. You're not a detective, Philip. She stressed my name in the way she does when she's trying, unsuccessfully, to hold on to her patience.
Kerry Height, narrating Light Seekers, written by my guest, Femi Kayode.
So what next for Philip and Chico then?
So I'm working on book two now. They are on another adventure. This time they are trying to sort out the case of a missing pastor's wife. And they're really stumped because it's a mega church and there are over 50,000 members of the congregation and it could be anybody. So
not a small cast.
It's not a small cast at all. I'm more excited about what's happening in Philip's personal life in this particular story because there's a lot of focus. Light Seekers is about fathers and sons. And I think the core relationship here is about fathers and daughters. And I really want to explore that. And I'm very, very excited about just processing it and asking questions from my friends that have daughters and all the issues that's going on. So right now, the working title is Gaslight. And I'm really looking forward to sharing it with fans of Philip Taiwo. I hope they like it. It's a bit more of a domestic noir than Light Seekers. Light Seekers is very much a social crime story, but this one is more domestic in a sense.
Well, Femi Kayode, I very much hope that you will come back when the second novel is written and will also come back at the end of the show for the books of your life.
Thanks, Hannah. Light Seekers by Femi Kayode is narrated by Kerry Height and available commercially. And Femi will be back at the end of the show to share the books of his life.
The RNIB is committed to providing life-changing support and specialist services. Services that we know people affected by sight loss need now more than ever. But we need your help. The coronavirus outbreak represents an unprecedented situation for all of us. For RNIB, it's having a huge impact on our ability to raise the money we need to continue vital services at a time when so many of us are feeling isolated and anxious. The need for access to information and to feel socially connected is critical for all of us. With an increase in demand, we're working hard to keep vital services running so that blind and partially sighted people don't have to face this crisis alone. But we need your help. This is a time for community and coming together, and we need your support now more than ever. Please help RNIB today to support the 2 million people in the UK with sight loss, their friends, family and carers. Donate at 0330 002 0893 or use the website rnib.org.uk/urgent appeal. Thank you.
You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come this week, Bill Skitworth reveals how lockdown prompted him to share his experience of sight loss by writing his memoirs. But before that, with all the disruption to schooling over the past months, it can be hard for children and their families to find room to read for pleasure. But the benefits of doing so are enormous, not least in allowing kids to step away from the pressures of daily life for a time. But books can also offer a different perspective on some of the issues that kids face every day, particularly when they're at school. Children's fiction has never shied away from tackling the big issues. Anjali Q. Ralph's novel, The Boy at the Back of the Class, is the story of Ahmet, a 10-year-old refugee from Syria Who is the new boy at a school in London? Written from the point of view of one of his classmates, a little girl who's determined to make friends with Ahmet and give him a sense of belonging, it's poignant, funny and utterly unforgettable. And I'm delighted to be joined by the book's author. Anjali Ralph, welcome to Read On.
Hello, Red. Hi. Such an honour to be here.
Well, thank you very much for coming in. So, can you introduce us to The Boy at the Back of the Class?
Sure. So, The Boy at the Back of the Class is a story about a young narrator who goes to a school, a London school, and one day a very strange young boy happens to walk in. And they're absolutely fascinated by why this boy is quiet and pale and withdrawn and sits at the back of the class. And they discover that the boy is actually a refugee and go on this amazing adventure to try and reunite him with his family.
And Ahmet, the refugee boy, is very quiet and withdrawn. Mm. And you make the point that actually in the absence of knowledge, rumours start to spread. So people are suspicious of him because he's not very forthcoming. And there are reasons for that, which it's only through the unnamed narrator and her friend's determination to interact with him as friends that we find out.
Yeah.
And those rumours are quite unpleasant, but not as unpleasant as actually some of the reasons why Ahmet is so quiet.
Yeah, absolutely. And the rumours are, I think it's a very natural thing to do when you don't know about someone. You guess stories about them. The unpleasant side of rumours is it can be quite nasty. So in the book, there are rumours that he might have a disease. And the fact that Ahmet doesn't speak English is another kind of layer of mystery for the children in the book. And I think the nastiness that can come with suspicions and fears are shown in the book to have had a grounding in the adult world that they're surrounded by, and the rumours that kind of fly out from certain words that children don't really understand. So there's also a double battle, if you like. So for Ahmet, he has to battle not just what he's been through and his experiences as a refugee, but also trying to make others understand who he is and where he has come from and why it is that he needs time and space to gather himself and become himself again.
And it's told from the point of view of a 9.5-year-old girl in very simple and yet very, very effective language. And I was wondering if that's why you felt that you needed to approach this global problem of refugees through the eyes of children, because it strips back the language.
Absolutely. So when I had a kind of meeting with my agent and she suggested that I start writing about the refugee crisis, my first instinct was to try and write an adult novel about it from the perspective of women who've been through it, because that's who I work with in Calais and Dunkirk. But I very quickly realised that actually it's children who have the most questions for me when I return from my journeys. It's they who are the most open-minded. And I think anybody with children or who work with children will understand just how razor-sharp their perception is. So it became the easiest thing in the world to sit down and write this book from the perspective of a child, especially since I'm surrounded by my nephews and nieces who have 1,000 questions about this so-called crisis, and I wanted to create something that they could turn to get some of those answers, because I don't think they really get it from the adult world, or we dismiss their questions very easily, or we tell them, you know, something they can deal with when they're older. But actually I think children have a very keen idea of what's going on. They want to know, and I think by stripping back the language and questioning what it is we're hearing, which is what children do all the time, we can really get to the heart of this refugee crisis, which is human beings in need. And I think children really latch onto that quite beautifully.
There's a wonderful and very resonant line at the beginning of the book with grown-ups always coming up with long words for simple yeah. things. And for me, that just pulsed all the way through the book. And you use that as a starting off point for simplifying the words that are used to describe people who have travelled from one place to another and what reasons they had to do so. So you unpick what the difference between a refugee and a migrant and an immigrant are. Could you do that for the listeners?
Absolutely. It's one of the most frustrating things that I find when we open up a newspaper or we're listening to the radio and we hear the term economic migrants, or these migrants have been coming to the shores of the UK, or immigrants are trying to get in. But there's a huge difference, the global difference between a refugee, a migrant and an immigrant. Now, migrants and immigrants have a choice. They choose to move. It may be for a new job. It may be they want to go to a different country to live in. It may be they've fallen in love and want to move for that. But if you're in a war zone, if you're facing environmental destitution, if you're being politically persecuted, you have no choice. And that's what makes a refugee so much more different than a migrant or an immigrant. You don't have a choice in why it is you're moving. You don't have a choice as to where it is you're going. You might be trying to reunite with family, but at the end of the day, your home is no longer safe enough for you to stay. And those terminologies that we use so flippantly sometimes, it can really have an impact on, you know, how we view refugees and how we view their purposes for moving and for giving up everything, for putting themselves at risk at sea, or, you know, however it is they're travelling, for putting their children at risk. And I think we really do need to be very careful of the words we use and try and understand that actually there's massive difference between similar sounding words and what they're deemed to mean by the adult world, I suppose. So I'm really keen for children to understand that refugees have no choice in what they're having to do. They're having to give up everything, whereas migrants and immigrants have a huge choice as to what it is that they are doing with their lives and their monies and their homes. And we need to separate those two kind of areas of labelling peoples.
And literacy is absolutely at the heart of this book, understanding what words mean and learning to understand as well. Your nameless heroine is surrounded by books. Her mum is a librarian. They don't have much, but they do have access to books. She's rather addicted to Tintin, which I think many of us growing up were. Yeah. And her mum comes up with a wonderful saying, which is, the best books leave you with more questions than answers. And that's the fun bit, finding some answers for yourself.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And that's the kind of book that you've written. In fact, it ends with seven questions for the reader, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Yeah. So I want this to be a jumping off ground. I want this story to get people and children and their parents and anybody else they're surrounded by to get discussions going about refugees and what they're seeing in the papers and have those discussions. And I think the most lovely thing that I've been hearing since the book came out is responses from grandparents who, especially Jewish grandparents, who've said, my children have never really asked me what it was like for me coming to the UK. But for the first time, they're coming back and asking me these questions. It's been lovely to have those discussions. So I think it's opening up very difficult areas of thought. And if it's doing that, then that makes me incredibly happy. Yeah. So, and there's seven questions at the back. They're there to kind of help along the process of not being afraid to ask yourself questions and not being afraid of the answers either.
And actually realising that there, but for the happy situation that we live in the UK, we too could become refugees. Mm-hmm. We, you know, what three things would we take with us if we had to leave our homes tomorrow? It's a wonderful way of making people focus on being empathetic.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think when it comes to the refugee crisis or any kind of humanitarian crisis where you're faced with endless faces that you will not know the names of, that you may never meet, it's very easy to switch the channel. It's very easy to switch off because there's this term called compassion fatigue, where you're just so overwhelmed by bad news, by horrible things happening, that you can't actually humanize the faces that you're seeing or humanize the names that you're hearing. And that's absolutely fine in one way, because it's a way of self-defense, it's a way of continuing in your own world without going crazy. But in another way, we have to try and focus in on those faces that we can get to know, that we can help and reach out to. And I think if we can start to do that just on a one-to-one basis, I think one of the biggest things that I hear when I'm going out to the refugee camps, etc., is it feels like nothing. You're just taking out a tent and some sleeping bags. What's that going to do? And my answer is always, if you can help just one person that day, then that's one person helped. We can do this one by one. It doesn't have to be in the millions and thousands, because that's beyond anybody's capacity, but you can do the one-on-one. So by empathizing, by understanding, by not being afraid to ask questions of ourselves and the faces that we're seeing, I'm hoping that, yes, we'll have some, I don't know, some grain of non-fear to ask and take forward our actions.
And also, by buying the book, we are also helping the refugees, because I believe you're donating a proportion of the royalties to charities that help.
Absolutely. So I work with a number of charities in Calais and Dunkirk who are receiving no help whatsoever. It's absolutely phenomenal, the human beings on the ground. It's so-called ordinary citizens like you and I who go out every weekend. Some have given up their lives, some have given up their studies to, you know, have stayed out there for years, and they desperately need help. So a proportion of the books will be going towards my works with them and hopefully trying to find solutions as well.
Now, we're dealing with very weighty issues, and I hope the listeners will be able to hear it in your voice. You have a great sense of fun, and it is very, very entertaining, fun book that I, as a grown-up, thoroughly enjoyed reading.
Oh, I'm so glad. Thank you.
You really enjoy turning people's perceptions on their heads. I mean, there are really nice drivers of black cabs in this book, and the people who you suspect might not be particularly nice do turn out to be really lovely. You clearly had great fun writing the book.
Absolutely. So I live in the East End of London. I have done for most of my life. And I've always been surprised at how the most unexpected people can come forward in times of need or help. So I have, for example, a neighbour who's a bus driver, and he's the most quietest person you'll ever see. I have another man on my road who's a road sweep. He sweeps the road every morning. He's got tattoos all the way up his arm. You'd never think that he would donate towards the refugee crisis, etc. But all of them are part of my works and my world. And I wanted to get people thinking not just about people we don't speak to, but also who we do speak to and who we do see every day, and to never underestimate the human being in front of you and the capacity to do something amazing. So it shocks me every day in my life, and I wanted that to come across in the book, and I'm so glad if it has, so thank you.
Are you working on another book?
Yes, I am. It's going to be called The Star Outside My Window, and it's about a young girl who goes on the hunt for her mother's star after something quite horrible has happened, and it features the Royal Observatory in Greenwich, which is where I was hanging out all day yesterday asking a million questions. But we'll see. I think it's going to come out in October, hopefully, if I can stick to schedule.
And that'll be, again, for the pre-teen market?
Or... Yeah, for middle grade, so 9+, yeah.
And the audiobook is an absolute delight. Imogen Wilde is a terrific narrator. Did you have anything to do with choosing her?
Oh, she's absolutely fantastic. So I got given by my publishers some names and some recordings of different voices. And her one, I think my agent actually said, I think she's just going to be phenomenal. And I absolutely agreed straight away. And she has this amazing raspiness in her voice. And because the book also tries to hide the gender in some ways, I thought it would be a perfect fit. And I didn't want it to be too polished, kind of, you know, very posh voice. I wanted it to be someone that could speak to the children and who they would listen to. So she was absolutely fantastic.
You must be delighted that as an audiobook, it's reaching an audience of print disabled people who might not otherwise get to read the book.
Absolutely.
Have you got any links to sight loss yourself within your own family?
So my grandfather actually became partially blind before he died a few years ago. And I have a deaf nephew and niece who are also having sight problems now because they have got a degenerative disease. So we're very aware of things that we can do as a family to help them. And it's a huge learning curve as well. So it's a gradual thing for me. I never had any people who were, or children who were experiencing sight loss in my school. So it's not something that we were brought up with, which I think is something that we need to tackle as well on a far wider scale. But on the family front, yes, in a very gentle way, I would say. It's not hit us very hard, but it's not something I live with daily, but it's something that I'm very aware of and that we're trying to learn to help with regards to my nephews and nieces.
Well, it did make me wish that someone would approach a child with sight loss at the back of the class in the same way that you have approached Ahmed and his story as a refugee. But who knows? Maybe a project for the future.
Hopefully so, yes.
Well, thank you so much for writing an amazing book that I can't recommend enough, and for coming into the Read On studios and sharing the story with us.
It's my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, for reading it as well. That's just the most wonderful thing to hear. Thank you.
The Boy at the Back of the Class is available in print, ebook, and as an audiobook, narrated brilliantly by Imogen Wilde.
After whispering for a few more seconds with Mrs. Khan, Mrs. Sanders left the classroom. We expected Mrs. Khan to say something, but she seemed to be waiting, so we waited too. It was all very serious and exciting. But before we could start guessing about what was going on, Mrs. Sanders came back, and this time she wasn't alone. Standing behind her was a boy. A boy none of us had ever seen before. He had short dark hair and large eyes that hardly blinked and smooth pale skin. "Everyone," said Mrs. Khan as the boy went and stood next to her, "this is Ahmet and he'll be joining our class from today. He's just moved to London and is new to the school, so I hope you'll all do your very best to make him feel welcome." We all watched in silence as Mrs. Sanders led him to the empty chair. I felt sorry for him because I knew he wouldn't like sitting next to Clarissa very much. She still missed Dina, and everyone knew she hated boys. She says they're stupid and smell. I think it must be one of the worst things in the world to be new to a place and have to sit with people you don't know. Especially people that stare and scowl at you like Clarissa was doing. I made a secret promise to myself right there and then that I would be friends with the new boy. I happened to have some lemon sherbets in my bag that morning, and I thought I would try and give him one at break time. And I would ask Josie and Tom and Michael if they would be his friends too. After all, having four new friends would be much better than having none. Especially for a boy who looked as scared and sad as the one now sitting at the back of our class.
Imogen Wilde narrating The Boy at the Back of the Class, written by my guest today, Anjali Q. Ralph. Both The Boy at the Back of the Class and its sequel, The Day We Met the Queen, are available from the RNIB Library as talking books and in Braille.
We know just how important reading can be for everyone, whether that's to keep you busy or just to put a smile on your face. The RNIB Reading Services online library is here for you. Register for an account at readingservices.rnib.org.uk and start reading straight away. Browse and download from our growing collection of over 30,000 talking books, newsagent titles and even sheet music on your smartphone, tablet, computer or other reading devices. RNIB Reading Services allows you to keep your books until you're finished and there's no need to renew. Get talking books in DAISY format. Enjoy a selection of e-braille books to work on an electronic braille display, such as the Orbit Reader 20. Search for RNIB Reading Services online or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999 and tell them you're interested in the Reading Services Library or any other of the great RNIB services we offer.
This is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to Femi Coyote to hear the books of his life.
As regular listeners will know, at Read On, we're passionate about audiobooks, blind authors, and our listeners. So, when a story comes in that features all three, it's something we've just got to cover. Bill Skipworth's book, Now I See, has just been published as a commercial audiobook, and he joined me from Sheffield to tell me all about it.
Up to being 36, I had perfect eyesight and, you know, I had a wonderful job, beautiful wife, new child, and my son had just been born, and everything in the world was wonderful. And then I got a dose of flu, which I recovered from, and everything seemed fine. And then I started getting bits in my eyes. Anyway, this triggered uveitis, which is like an inflammation in the eyes, both eyes, and then this triggered glaucoma, which most people know is high pressure. And my eyesight has been sort of gradually going from the age of 36. And it's a long, long story, and hence the fact that I've written it in a book. And eventually, I lost all my sight out of my right eye, and then sight out the bottom of my left eye. And then I had some medical intervention, and I got some of my sight back after going completely blind for about 4 or 5 months. Completely blind, but the doctors, wonders of the NHS, brought my sight back with a silicone implant. It is an amazing story, and of course, when it happened to me, I wanted to write it down, hence the book, which, of course, in lockdown, everybody wanting something to do in lockdown, and so I've written the book during lockdown, and I'm getting fantastic press from it. Everybody that's read it, you know, sighted people and partially sighted people and blind people, I mean, it's just fantastic, the response I'm getting for it, because it really gives an insight into the blind and visually impaired world.
It's been published by a publisher in Sheffield been made into an audiobook as well.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's Steel City Press, and it's called Now I See by Bill Skipworth. And funnily enough, I mean, I'm plugging the book, obviously, but the graphic designer has done the most wonderful cover, which is like an eye chart, you know, all the letters on an eye chart. and then it's designed. So you look at it and you think, what's this? And then you can see the words, now I see, you know, done in there. I mean, it's really clever design. And yeah, I'm very, very pleased with it.
And over the years of sight loss, you have experienced, well, pretty much the whole gamut, from having limited sight loss to complete sight loss to other things such as Charles-Bonnet syndrome.
That's right. In fact, I mean, I jokingly say to people, because in the blind world, I'm like an Exocet missile, because I've basically had everything. I've had the Charles-Bonnet syndrome. And I've also developed this condition called synesthesia, because I learned to play the piano when I was very young. As my sight loss progressed, I developed the ability to see colours through keys on the piano. And even I'm experiencing it, and I think it's weird, really, very strange. And then, of course, the Charles-Bonnet is when you have these hallucinations, which when you're in the middle of having these Charles-Bonnet syndrome hallucinations, they can be horrific. And again, that's all in the book. I mean, if anybody's been into Alton Towers, you know, and gone on one of these scariest rides ever, well, just going on in the car with the Charles-Bonnet syndrome, it was like the most terrifying ride ever, just driving in a car, you know, because of the hallucinations, you know. But it's, again, I explain that in the book. It's very hard to explain to someone who's never had it. It really is awful. But yeah, there's lots and lots of things in the book. And of course, the other thing that I find quite amusing is the fact that I grew up in Scunthorpe, which thrives on steel. And then, of course, I moved to Sheffield, which is a steel city. So it's like going from one steel place to another steel place. And that's the background to the story, the two places I've lived in growing up in Scunthorpe, which, again, and there's a lot of amusing stories in it. Because, you know, it is autobiographical. But the mass majority of the story is about my sight loss. And again, it's it goes over a long period of time, you know, from 36 to I'm now 67. And yeah, because I've got some of my sight back, I mean, I'm just permanently happy. You know, I'm one of these nauseating people that just happy all the time because, you know, just walking down a street and knowing that I can actually walk down the street without falling over anything. People who are blind or visually impaired realise what I'm talking about. And no, I'm sure you do.
Yes, and hence the title, because it is the realisation of how much you had lost and how glad you are to have some of that sight back.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I have a Christian faith, and that comes out in the book, you know, from beginning to end. But people say it's not too sort of in your face, you know, because some people get quite offended if you talk about God and things. But it comes out in the book because, you know, when you have a sight problem, it becomes part of your life, doesn't it? You can't sort of pretend it's not there. You know, you are visually impaired or blind or whatever it is, and it just affects everything. And in the same way, my faith comes out in all kinds of different ways in the book, you know, how it helped me to cope with things. But I've been very, very surprised that even non-believers or people with no faith who read the book really enjoy it and are not offended by it, which I was a bit worried about because some people do get very offended sometimes.
The real impetus behind this book, though, is spreading the word about sight loss so that a sighted audience can understand better what we go through.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And part of that is also having it in as many accessible forms as possible. And clearly it was very important to get the book recorded as an audiobook. How was that experience?
From what I understand, it's quite an achievement to get a book on Audible. And anyway, my publisher, again, he's just worked it all out and done it all for me. And again, what is extraordinary is that I said, well, I wanted it, obviously, for the blind world. And I said, I want an audio, you know, CD. And I said, ideally, I'd want to combine Scunthorpe, because obviously it's a Lincolnshire accent, and Sheffield accent, you see. And, of course, I've lived in Scunthorpe for 20 years, and I've lived here for, you know, 40-odd years. And then my publisher said, well, what will my dad do? Because he was born and brought up in Scunthorpe and now lives in Sheffield. So that was absolutely extraordinary. So he did the audio description, and it's got a really nice voice, and of course it's the accent that I wanted, which is a fairly unique Scunthorpe stroke Sheffield accent, you know, so I was really pleased about that.
As the weeks went by, my sight had become very poor, as Dr. Gold had warned me it would. I could tell it wasn't related to the glaucoma. Just imagine you're rubbing a pencil drawing away that you've just done. With glaucoma, it feels like the thing which I could see before had just disappeared. Soon, I couldn't see well enough to read. Then I couldn't see well enough to make a cup of tea. And very quickly, I descended into total blindness.
Leslie Arnott, narrating Now I See. Bill Skitworth, thank you so much for taking us into your memoir. Best of luck with the book, and thank you for being a guest on the show.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you.
Now I See by Bill Skitworth is available in print, ebook, and as an Audible download through Amazon.
The current times can be especially challenging for people with sight loss.
For dedicated advice, support, or to access our free talking books and reading services, call RNIB's helpline on 0303 123 9999.
The helpline's open 8 till 8 on weekdays and Saturdays from 9 till 1.
Standing with you through every challenge. RNIB. See differently.
Now it's back to Femi Coyote for the books of his life.
Femi Coyote, welcome back. So, is there a book that as a child or a young person made you want to become a writer?
I always start off this question by saying, I know the book that made me want to be a storyteller. And it was a stage play by a late Nigerian playwright called Olarotimi. And it's called The Gods Are Not to Blame. And it was based on Oedipus Rex, which is a Greek play. And I remember watching it, and I must have been like 15 when I watched it. And I said to myself, I wish I could tell a story like this. And then I think the book that really made me want to be a writer would be The Naked Face by Sidney Sheldon. It was fast, it was pacey, and it was so beautifully written. It felt like watching a movie. Now, remember, Sidney Sheldon was also a screenwriter, an Oscar-winning screenwriter, and you could see it when you read the book. You could see the book. You could see the story unfold in front of you. And I remember telling myself, I must have been like 17 or something when I told myself, this is the kind of writer I want to be. Those would be the two most memorable books. But the writer that moves me the most is a guy called John Ivan. And I remember A Son of the Circus was just this book that transported me to another world entirely. And I was so fascinated by the fact that this is an American guy writing about a world that's just made come alive so much. And I was like, okay, after Sidney Sheldon, then it's John Ivan. I think those are the three books of my growing up that really, really shaped my approach to storytelling.
Judd squeezed the edge of the table, his knuckles white. What time was Hansen here this morning? Asked Angeli. 10 o'clock. How long do your sessions last, Doctor? 50 minutes. Did he leave as soon as it was over? Yes, I had another patient waiting. Did Hansen go out through the reception office? No, my patients come in through the reception office and leave by that door. They indicated the private door leading to the outside corridor. In that way, they don't meet each other. McGreevy nodded. So, Hansen was killed within a few minutes of the time he left here. Why was he coming to see you? Judd hesitated. I'm sorry. I can't discuss a doctor-patient relationship. Someone murdered him, McGreevy said. You might be able to help us find his killer.
William Roberts, narrating The Naked Face by Sidney Sheldon, which is available commercially, although you can find many of Sheldon's other books in the RNIB library.
Is there a book that you like to curl up with on a rainy day and reread?
A Little Life by Anya Yanigara. It is the most beautiful book. It's actually got shortlisted for the Booker, and it's the most heartbreaking book. But I love it so much because the language is so intimate. And when you talk about calling up and just holding it and just closing the world away, that's the book that I always think about. Either that or The Cider House Rules by John Ivan. I love books about pain. You know, after The Son of the Circus, I remember that it was Sophie's Choice by William Styron. I would read that book over and over and over again. You know, so any one of those three books works.
In those days, cheap apartments were almost impossible to find in Manhattan. So I had to move to Brooklyn. This was in 1947, and one of the pleasant features of that summer, which I so vividly remember, was the weather, which was sunny and mild, flower fragrant. almost as if the days had been arrested in a seemingly perpetual springtime. I was grateful for that, if for nothing else, since my youth, I felt, was at its lowest ebb. At 22, struggling to become some kind of writer, I found that the creative heat, which at 18 had nearly consumed me with its gorgeous, relentless flame, had flickered out to a dim pilot light, registering little more than a token glow in my breast, or wherever my hungriest aspirations once resided.
William Hope narrating Sophie's Choice by William Styron, which is available from the RNIB Library.
And lastly, is there a book that you read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Honestly, is My Sister the Serial Killer? I had to interview Onyekan, the writer, for a festival. So I had to read the book. And I read it and I had I drew lines through it and all that. So that's the book that I've read recently that really, really I would recommend. It's easy to read. It's quite deep and just so well written. I like that a lot. Yes, on the side is The Light Between Oceans. It's the one I just finished now.
I bet you didn't know that bleach masks the smell of blood. Most people use bleach indiscriminately, assuming it is a catch-all product, never taking the time to read the list of ingredients on the back. Never taking the time to return to the recently wiped surface to take a closer look. Bleach will disinfect, but it's not great for cleaning residue, so I use it only after I have first scrubbed the bathroom of all traces of life and death. It is clear that the room we are in has been remodeled recently. It has that never-been-used look, especially now that I've spent close to 3 hours cleaning up. The hardest part was getting to the blood that has seeped in between the shower and in the caulking. It's an easy part to forget. There's nothing placed on any of the surfaces. His shower gel, toothbrush and toothpaste are all stored in the cabinet above the sink. Then there's the shower mat, a black smiley face on a yellow rectangle in an otherwise white room. Ayola is perched on the toilet seat, her knees raised and her arms wrapped around them. The blood on her dress has dried, and there is no risk that it will drip on the white, now glossy floors.
Werruchi Opia narrating My Sister, the Serial Killer by Oyinkan Braithwaite, which is available from the RNIB Library.
Femi Coyote, thank you so much for joining us on Read On, and we look forward to hearing all about your next book when it's published.
Thank you so much for having me, Hannah. It was such fun.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today, but Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your preferred provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at RedSail, which is REDSZELL, and Robert Kirkwood is at Talking_Books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week. And don't forget to read on.